And welcome back to the second half of this reading. I've spent a lot of time in my life watching my dad and his work. He's a man who has always wanted to do things pretty perfectly. He has had a standard, and he's been very grumpy with certain people when they haven't met that standard. And he worked at carpentry and pretty much anything to do with house building and plumbing and those kinds of things. But he's older now, and things have changed for him. This piece is about that. My father is losing sleep about perfection. A man who all his life pursued the plumb straightness of his lines is watching without capacity to change the ups and downs and wavering of lesser work performed in his domain. And he doesn't sleep well, not anymore. My father is calling helpers in these days. He can't shift the bricks and pavers to lay them down in harmony. His strength has left him overnight, or perhaps crept away in these last few flying years. Growing old is also growing anger at the need to call for assistance from incompetence and fools. My father is holding on to pride and dignity by forcing sundry artisans and labourers to relay bricks and pavers into the honest straight lines of plumb bob and spirit level, that a man may watch all day with the satisfaction of a lifetime spent pursuing small perfections and building pride. Father's Day last weekend. All right. Whenever I read in public, I get snippy. Wait till I get to Sad Palms. Oh. I wrote a series of pieces that I thought were influenced by the Chinese Book of Wisdom, the Tao Te Ching. What they really amounted to was an exploration on my part of things that happen as they're meant to happen. You don't get to change, and they just happen. And so a series of what I call way poems. This is way poem number 5, The Five Steps to Wheaton Pecks. He progresses 5 steps at a time to reach a wall or a fence that he can lean on. Air that tastes so sweet is hard these days to come by. A moment of rest till the gasps calm down to normal breathing, then 5 steps more, and 5 steps more again. It's important to keep moving, even though the atmosphere is so thin down here on planet Earth. For the hen, the last remaining hen, is waiting. She has no flock to be a part of. They have passed away one by one to a cat, to a fox, to a feather-depleting old age. And now she waits for the shuffle of him beside the yard gate. In the nest is a single egg. He sits beside her laying box on a chair he placed there some time ago, his palm covered in golden wheat. She dainty steps until she can stand upon him, on his knees, to take each grain, one peck at a time, until they are all gone. Then she leaves him and goes to forage in the yard again, and he can take his 5 steps all the way back to what remains of his life. We got some coffee drinkers here? No? Anyone? Really? Leanne and I roast coffee as a ritual from green beans. I roast them, all right.
I burn it.
Green
too much and it's burnt.
Green beans to a roast. And then we grind and pop them on the stove in percolator and we do milk on the stovetop. This piece is called To a Higher Place, and it's about that kind of process. It may actually even be about me. I wouldn't want to own up to it particularly, but it could be. Boil, you slow to bubble Philistine way face of wasted time. He is talking to, at, the milk, poured into a saucepan on the stovetop. The brown grumbler over there is roaring its head off at me, and you are not even trying. Haste, or I'll tip you out and start over. He doesn't mean that, not really. But judging the sweet timing that brings coffee to percolation at the same time as milk to the boil is art rather than science. And his agitation to achieve precision itself boils over into impatience when he has to wait on one element or the other. There you are. He's crooning now. Bubble, bubble, the whole surface over. Bubble and bubble. Now I can quick you to the cup. The coffee is still complaining, a slightly slower scowl in the percolator. And nothing has been lost. The flavour is bitter, sweet. Who knows? Perhaps his routine of distress and irritability had an alchemical effect. Regardless, it is his way to the higher place, and every day he gets there. Way poem number 9. Most folk who have had anything to do with the hospital system will know that we measure oxygen saturation in the blood by a little doodad on the fingertip these days. Poor saturation, low sats. How much oxygen in your fingers? 100% sats? 95? How your lungs must work so when you love your cigarette. Do you know that this is dying? I wonder, do you care? Light another cigarette, old friend of mine, old fool. How much oxygen in your fingers? 88% sats? 83%? You can feel the world starting to close in, but still, another cigarette will help to clear your head. Let me light you up, old idiot, old good friend. I can see you are dying anyway. How much oxygen in your fingers? 65% sats, down to 38%. And you don't feel much like cigarettes when there's an ambulance in your doorway to put the mask across your face. Try to breathe while the machine's still yelping. Breathe, for life is all there is, dear boy. How much dioxide in your fingers? I fear there is no room. No room for any more. Mm-hmm. 2 years ago, I fell in love. I found it with a man. I found a French philosopher by the name of Gaston Bachelard. He died back in 1960, so it's a bit weird. But his writings were on science and also on the imagination, and particularly the poetics as associated with imagination. And I found that I, for a while, couldn't read a paragraph without having an idea that I had to try and catch somehow to convert from what he wrote into my understanding of what is a poem. These are all new. I haven't really had a chance to road test these, so welcome. Three pieces from my Bachelard collection. This one's Drawing an Idea. It started as a sketch. The artist, pencil in hand, began with a few lines on a white paper that almost shone in its pristine beauty. An invitation to convert a dream, an idea, or an image into some semblance of itself via a kind of chemistry on the page. Rapidly, the picture evolved, a broad shape, some detail, face, feet, attire, attitude. The idea thinned and became opaque, gradually began to vanish, while the sketch grew and became sharper, developed texture and depth. At last, the few remaining lines were cross-hatched in graphite. Until picture complete, the pencil fell to the ground, breaking the remaining lead from its tip, while the artist, shaded in greys, strolled beyond the pristine edge of the white paper and shrank step by step into perspective. The white paper almost shone in a snow-white gleam of beauty. A pencil, sharp and new, rested on the easel, waiting, patient, for another artist and another idea. I've got two pieces that I wanted to dedicate to the librarians. Jenny, two pieces dedicated to the librarians at Beechworth Library.
Oh, thank you.
You can tune out again now. Just wanted you to know. The Hermits of Reading. He has been wandering lost in the darkness of a densely treed forest. Lost long enough to doubt his reason, his purpose in entering these woods at night. But it was a desperation that drove him, that drives him still, clutching fiercely his sole possession of any value in both hands and held tightly against his body. He stumbles, comes near to falling, but rights himself and maintains his grip. All the time, he is casting about wildly as though to penetrate the dark with one correct glance. And there he sees it. Surely there it is, a flicker, a small flower of light. He is saved. His purpose holds. Staggering now, he proceeds by path and by tree root until the way is clear. The hut of the hermit stands before him, a light spreading wide from a single lantern, seated on the sill of a window. Clustered around as far as the edge of this spill of illumination, his fellow seekers, arrayed each with his personal most precious possession, open, printed pages held to the light. Lips move, fingers touch the page, but each holy word is read in reverent silence. I have a prop for this next piece. Necessary preparations. Remembering the last time, he resolved on this occasion to be prepared. Beside him he laid out a range of possible requirements. Bow and quiver filled with arrows. Snorkel and mask. An evening suit with bow tie. Hiking boots. Fishing line and a lunchbox containing 3 cheese sandwiches. A drinking glass filled with water. A chainmail vest. Laying them down within easy reach, he surveyed the assortment, nodded thoughtfully to himself. Yes, they may not meet every possibility, but he felt a little better prepared for what may come. Finally, he placed a large, hand-drawn sign penned in a red marker pen. Gone reading! Then opened the book to the page, to the line where he had left off the night before, and began to read. We all need to make necessary preparations. Another collection that I want to bring out in book form is a bushfire collection that I wrote about the 2009 fires, the Black Saturday fires. 10th anniversary is in February. It's astonishing to think that it's gone by so quickly. At the time, we were in John Street, and we could see the glow at the back of the hills. Didn't come closer than that, but that was well and truly close enough. But we were swamped, as everyone was, with the news, the disasters, the worry, the constant everything of those fires. And it was just devastating. And I could not stop hearing the voices, you know, reading them in the paper, hearing them on the news. And I wrote, as one does. So a few poems from that. I find them a bit emotional to read, but we'll have a go. This is Surviving the Devil. That's the name of the collection and the name of this piece. Oh, my darling, the devil is in the wind, crying, roaring, swallowing sound with every tongue that licks to taste the grass and trees. It speaks to you, my darling. Well, we could really only watch, It came down the hill, on both sides and from behind us, from four ways at once. The embers were like an Uzi, firing through every crack. Doors, windows, skylights in the ceiling. If you were putting them out at the top of the door, they swarmed in at the bottom. It was like a live thing. If we stayed in the house another 30 seconds, we were dead. If we got in the car to drive away, we were dead. We could only back the sedan onto burnt ground, sit in it and watch our home burn down. It took just a few seconds. I couldn't breathe. I just couldn't breathe. We both had damp cloths over our mouths, but I just couldn't breathe. Even now, I'm coughing up black. Darling, my darling, there is sorrow on this ground. The devil's kiss is a thirst that can't be quenched. And the taste in your mouth is the ash and the foul of a love affair to the death. Oh, my darling, the world is different now from when he began. Look, I'm telling you, my truck didn't burn, it melted. It just bloody well melted. There's some MIDI files, a pair of socks, some underpants, my camera, and the budgerigar. That's all I had time to grab. The rest's gone. I hope the cat's okay. My horses. I need to go back in to save my horses. Are you going to stop me from going to them? They need me. Are you trying to make me lose everything? Let me go through. Somebody lit it on purpose. What do you do to someone like that? What on earth do you do? Darling, this is the devil's stamping ground. Turn into a moonscape in the space of 3 hours. This is where he sings songs of desecration. It's going to take probably a couple of generations for it to grow back. His sickling ground to corrupt with gouts of loathing. I'm not sure if this place, our home for over 25 years, can ever feel the same for us. Come away with me, my darling, come away. There is fire in the red sun's eye. I think we've had enough of living in the wonderful Australian bush. There is nothing left where the devil wind has blown. Yes, and I'm just a truckie from up Canberra way. I gave up my time because I could. Took a load of square bales down south where they'll be hand-feeding their beasts for weeks into months until the rain comes. There'll be no green pick for a cow or a sheep down there. The cockies around Canberra burnt out in 2003, and there's not much going spare this year. But they remember the help that came while they were all still black and bewildered. So I loaded my rig and pointed us south. Another 11 blokes came behind me on the freeway. Now, I'm a bloody big guy and I can be a hard man. You have to be strong to survive in a tough old game. But I couldn't believe what I saw when I topped the last of the hills. And I feel no shame in telling you. I had to stop my rig by the roadside and cover my eyes. It is difficult to read. And then came the Royal Commission, and it all happened over again, all the stories, all in the Ark for a while, one of the stories that came up then. Well, you have to go back to the chaos of that time, back in February. As the day got on, we realised we were in pretty big strife, because the thing was bigger and hotter and faster and more unpredictable. It was more everything, really. And we'd started to get word of big losses in other places around and about. People, property, animals, whole towns. So we were head down and bum up and worried about what was going to happen next. Well, anyway, out of the smoke came a sort of convoy, led by a horse that was held on a halter by a woman driving a ute. In back she had a dog that was running around like a mad thing. Then after that came another car with a float and two more horses on the back. Next was a vehicle that a police fellow was driving. He'd been up in the chopper trying to winch people out, but the wind got too big, so he dropped down and helped by driving the car with whoever he could get into it. Then there was a couple of deer. Apparently they jumped out of the bush when the vehicles went past a clearing. And a couple of koalas. And three kangaroos. And then two lizards. all running with the convoy. They scattered pretty quick when the convoy emerged from the smoke and the flames, but it was all in together for a while. Don decides. Don across the road is smiling tonight, putting his kids into the back seat of the car. Two little girls. They're babbling about the dog, about school today, about something. And he looks around like he can't believe it's all just the way it's supposed to be. Last Saturday, he packed the car, doused the walls of the house with water, covered the motorbike and left it out in the street, settled the girls into the car, looked out at the bare paddocks that border Mellish Street and the smoke rising up from the Buckland Gap, said a mental goodbye and took his darlings away to safety. Today, he's wondering if he should really have gone, because the fire didn't get this far after all. But he looks at his girls and holds them close, and he knows he'll do it again exactly the same any time smoke rises. And so shall we all. That's nearly all of it. One piece to finish. If you'd like to be kept informed of readings that I'm going to do in future, or book activity as it comes along, there's a sheet of paper on the table there for email address and your preferred name, so I'll happily pop in my database. And if you want to make a comment about today and whether you've enjoyed or not, or what you've enjoyed or not, please feel free to do that. I'll be happy to receive all. There's also a couple of books there, the last of the stock, $10 a copy, $15 a pair, to a good home. This is the last piece of the set. This is about a couple, or inspired by a couple that I saw walking the streets of Beechworth some few years ago now, and I still see them. They were an old couple then. They look exactly the same to me now. I called it Arthur and Alice, a feature on Ford Street. And just as an aside, I had this piece appear in an online magazine. And sometime after it appeared, I was approached with a request. Apparently, an old couple had come across the piece somewhere, and they were going to reaffirm their vows and were asking permission to have it read at their ceremony. And I thought, wow, no. All right, Arthur and Alice, feature on Ford Street. Arthur and Alice found each other one day back in 59. That's 1959. He was a young man with hair slicked and tongue tied, no aspiration greater than a seat at the Flicks with a girl as beautiful as Alice was a slender reed, hardly of an age to say yes to next Saturday night if her mother could talk to her father and if Arthur came for her, freshly scrubbed and standing tall, to shake her dad's hand. Then an easy walk to see the movie with a newsreel and a serial thriller thrown in, as shown on the billboard at the corner of Camp Street and Ford. A bag of chips from the Dolphin Cafe to share at intermission, as thrilling as the main feature. Arthur and Alice walk in the town every day. The old man stands tall with his hair slicked, speaks quietly to Alice, her little frame at risk of an unauthorised journey from a tug of the gentle breeze. Slow steps and hand in hand, theirs is a small world made only for two. Arthur is anchor, Alice is home. Together they've featured in a day-to-day serial not made for the newsreel or the billboard wired to the tree at the corner of Camp Street and Ford, but playing privately in a small house an easy walk from town. Thank you.